Oh, really? Oh, bless you.
I don't know, are you on? Oh, yeah.
Good evening, and welcome to this evening's programme talk of the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. My name is Natanya Rolotta, and I'm the Honorary Secretary for SIAS. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next program talk will be a discussion on climate change given by members of the IFOA Climate Change Working Parties on Tuesday, the 3rd of September. Further details and online registration for this event will be available on SIAS's website shortly. And then we are running a best exam mark competition this July and will award student members of SIAS who achieve the best mark for each IFOA exam a £50 Amazon voucher and a £50 donation to their chosen charity. We remind all eligible candidates to send us their exam results letter for the April 2019 sitting along with their chosen charity before the 25th of July. And we will announce the winners in our August newsletter, so please do keep an eye out for that. Our annual SIAS boat party will take place on the 26th of July. Further details and tickets for this event are available on our website. Next, a few standard notices about tonight's event. Tonight's event is hosted by SIAS. We do encourage those of you that aren't currently SIAS members to join SIAS. Membership is extremely good value, £23 for IFOA fellows and £12 for students. And further details again are available on the website. There's an attendance sheet in the smaller room just outside the hall. If you didn't sign this on your way in, don't forget to sign it on your way out. Attendance at these talks does not get automatically added to your CPD record, so please remember to update your CPD in the normal way after tonight. We're eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible and would be delighted to hear any feedback you have. We will email you a short online survey after the talk, so please do take some time to complete this. We need your feedback to create the best possible experience for our members. If the fire alarm sounds during the meeting, please exit using the exits at the back of the hall. And finally, a reminder to switch your mobile phones to silent. Tonight's talk will last around an hour and be followed by a Q&A with a speaker. If you have a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. We value everyone's contribution at our talks, so there's a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student member and also a fellow of the IFOA. So please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before you ask your questions tonight. Following the meeting, there will be sandwiches and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall, so please do join us for that. Back to tonight's talk. Our speaker, Nicola Oliver, is the founder of Medical Intelligence UK Limited, established in 2007, a consultancy dedicated to providing impartial, expert insights into the main drivers behind changes in life expectancy and disease risk for the insurance industry. Nicola works directly with clients to increase their understanding of the medical and socio-demographic elements that impact mortality, morbidity, and longevity risk. A leading mortality and longevity expert, Nicola provides full consulting support to clients from across the insurance spectrum. She has supported clients with underwriting, annuity pricing, and product development, as well as internal model calibration to fulfill regulatory requirements. Nicola's background includes a long career in the UK National Service, firstly in intensive care and latterly in public health. Nicola is an affiliate member of the IFOA and is chair of the IFOA Diabetes Working Party and deputy chair of the IFOA Antibiotic Resistance Working Party. On that note, over to you, Nicola.
Thank you. That sounds really impressive, doesn't it? Okay, thanks everybody for coming tonight. Going to be talking about air pollution, as you know. The first part will focus on the specific health effects of air pollution, looking at the different compounds that we're all breathing on a daily basis, and then look at some of the challenges and how as an industry we can tackle this. I'm certainly not going to tell you what to do on a personal level, because I think we're all pretty well aware mentioned, I look at some of the sources of air pollution because these are really widely imagined. The key compounds, of which there are numerous, but there are two or three that are particularly noxious and that have a particular role to play in health and disease. And what the industry and the wider aspects of how we can tackle. Because we know that exposure to air pollution affects every stage of your life, from before you were born, as a young child, through into your middle age, and as an elderly person. And in fact, there's plenty of evidence that suggests that if a pregnant woman is exposed to enough levels of air pollution, this will affect the young baby in terms of reduced weight, and that has further implications for the baby later on in life. We also know that children are actually continuing to grow and develop their lungs right through to the age of 9 or 10 at least. If children are exposed to enough air pollution, the lungs actually do not grow. Pediatricians are reporting high levels of admission to intensive care of children in London throughout the year. This is something that's never happened before. And even children being admitted with in extremis with their asthma, and cases of asthma are soaring. And children are dying of asthma in London and certainly around the world. Now, this has come from the World Health Organization. Here we can see the sources of air pollution, which I'm sure we're pretty well conversant with. And you can see some of the compounds that have been highlighted there. Now, we're going to be focusing on outdoor pollution. There is, of course, quite a case for indoor air pollution in countries where it's still a practice to cook over carbon. And in fact, actually, there's a trend now for wood-fired stoves in the UK, and you're exposing yourself to carbon compounds and particulate matter if you do happen to have an open flame inside your house. So numerous sources of air pollution. I won't go into too much detail on every single one, but the obvious one straight away we all know are road transport. And this is principally more or less a result of diesel emissions, particularly in older vehicles. This is why we're seeing the ultra-low emission zones emerging, trying to stop the movement of these types of vehicles in and out of cities with heavy fees to be paid for by the drivers, and also the complete ban on diesel vehicles from several cities in Europe. And in fact, Paris has just released a complete ban on diesel before a certain registration year, I forget which.
Nicola, sorry to interrupt. I've just been told that someone's bicycle is in the courtyard and it may get removed. So if your bicycle is there, it's perhaps worth moving it.
All bicycles to be encouraged. Yeah, so road transport was a big problem. Energy and manufacturing, well, that's obvious. So emissions that come directly from burning of fossil fuels and carbon, but also the type of emissions that come as a result of manufacturing of certain products. So we're talking about such things as even everyday paints and varnishes. Residential and small-scale commercial combustion, so that's just open fires inside and outside of people's homes. Agriculture, and we'll see in a little while how that's becoming more of an interest in terms of whether we should be encouraging less use of animals in farming in terms of their carbon footprint versus the carbon footprint of a purely plant-based or a much heavier plant-based diet over animals. And an interesting category there called fugitive emissions. So these are basically accidental waste that comes from manufacturing, run up into rivers and also into the air. So brickworks, refineries, cement works, the whole sort of gamut of industrial manufacturing is hugely to blame. So a couple of the compounds that I'm particularly interested in, and that I'll talk to you about, are going to be PM, which is particulate matter, and also any of the oxides of nitrogen. And as I mentioned previously, there's been a move towards trying to understand where our greenhouse emissions are coming from, and this comes into the category of air pollution as well, because of the carbon that is placed into the air. And some of the compounds that we know are released into the air react with ozone on the ground level and produce the smog that you may well be familiar with.
So here's a study that's only just come out in the last week or two, undertaken by the University of Oxford, just giving us an idea of the greenhouse gas emissions that come from categories of 100 grams of protein, beef versus what you can see there. So beef is right off the scale at one end, and plants, peas, nuts, etc. are at the other end. So we know that this is becoming a problem. The World Health Organization estimates that around 7 million deaths a year could be attributed to air pollution. And within that, they are talking about indoor and air pollution. And the three areas of chief concern are not just what you might imagine. There are respiratory systems. We think about noxious gases and how they might affect your lungs. But air pollution is also implicated in increased risk for heart disease and heart disease mortality, and increased risk of stroke. When that's broken down into the different categories around the world, the different regions, the problems are greater for those who are most vulnerable in some of the poorer nations of the world. So this is where possibly the greatest impact is taking place. But that's not to say that we don't have problems also in the European region. Public Health England made their own estimations. Now it must be said that these are very much a real guesstimation about the number of deaths that arise as a result of air pollution, because there is no analysis that exists at the moment in which we can say, okay, these are the amount of people that are going to die, this is the excess mortality that we could witness as a result of air pollution now. And so this is just an estimation based on the hospital admissions, people with asthma, older people, etc. And as I mentioned a couple of times, one of the compounds of key interest is particulate matter. And 1 nanogram per square meter reduction in this particular compound could prevent, according to Public Health England, into the future, a good number of cases of heart disease, stroke, asthma, and lung cancer. And there was a study that was published around about 3 months ago in which the Royal College of Physicians are very concerned that they're now seeing cases of lung cancer at an increasing rate in non-smokers. So this potentially could also be linked to the current exposure to air pollution. Bearing in mind there's around about a 20-year lag from when you first develop lung cancer to when you actually present with symptoms. It's a very slow, asymptomatic disease that unfortunately does not present until you're in the very late stage. So as I mentioned, there are two compounds that are of key interest because we, in many ways, are much more able to be monitored, but also we know the direct effects of these two compounds. Now the first one is particulate matter, and there is absolutely no threshold at which exposure is safe. So health effects occur at every single level of exposure for particulate matter. And these are simply small compounds ranging from soot down to much more microscopic compounds. And they are described in terms of their size. PM10 is a particulate matter compound that is 10 micrometers or less in diameter. And on the little pictogram up there, you can see that PM10, we also have PM2.5. So PM10 could wrap itself, several PM10 could wrap around human hair. There's a piece of sand by comparison, and PM2.5 is even smaller. So in its largest particulate size, PM10, this obviously becomes inhaled into the lungs and can decrease lung function, so you get wheeziness and respiratory problems. In people with existing respiratory conditions, this is particularly a problem. So young or any age person with asthma, and also older people with existing chronic lung conditions. And then we get into the much smaller size of particle. The 2.5 is implicated in eye irritations and skin diseases. And in fact, we now understand that even smaller sizes, so less than one, are actually implicated in cardiovascular disease, possibly even cancer. And this is because not only do you inhale those particulates into your lungs, but they then enter your circulatory system. They are small enough to be able to do that. So often these are carbon-based particulates, and therefore they have exert a very similar effect to what you might see in inhaling carbon from the inhalable and highly dangerous. And PM particulate matter is the result of basic burning of carbon material. It comes out of diesel, it comes out of all vehicle emissions. And if you see a particularly old diesel car that doesn't have the correct sort of filter or a clean filter, you can actually see black smoke coming out. That is particulate matter. So public health England looks specifically at exposure to particulate matter and very much implicated in in heart disease as well as asthma, stroke, and some suggestion of course now that they're very much implicated in lung cancer. And as I mentioned before, low birth weight. And it's suspected that when a pregnant mother inhales particulate matter in sufficient quantities, that there is an interruption or a lessening in blood supply to the fetus. This results in the reduced birth weight because if the baby is not receiving enough oxygen during the pregnancy, then the baby will not grow to sufficient size and will have low birth weight. Along with that comes a lot of disease for the child in future life. The other compounds are the oxide of nitrogen. I've got of the three different types there. Nitric oxide, nitrogen dioxide, and nitrogen monoxide. And these come from electricity supply and mining, as well as the exhaust of all vehicles. This is another vehicle emission compound. And this is very much implicated in respiratory problems, again, for those who have existing lung vulnerabilities, but also have been implicated in actually bringing on asthma. The development of asthma can probably be attributed in some way to both the activities of particulate matter as well as some of the oxide of nitrogen. The other issue with this particular compound is it reduces lung immunity. So again, a greater problem in older people who may already have vulnerabilities in the respiratory system, also have a compromised immune system, and so this is a particular problem for our older population. Looking beyond the lungs, we now know that it may have as well implications in cardiovascular disease. There are some thoughts again around low birth weight, lung cancer, and even dementia. But certainly very much a problem for people who have asthma, and also, as I mentioned just previously, implicated in the development of asthma. So the health effects of air pollution are quite wide-ranging. In the short term, you may well have experienced this yourself, but coughing, wheezing, shortness of breath, this is a short-term and immediate and acute symptom. If you already have asthma, you may experience exacerbation, particularly when it's on sunnier days, warmer days, sunlight and ozone react together to form other compounds. And as I mentioned before, from fetus to elderly age, we know that air pollution has a far-reaching effect. On a long-term basis, evidence is becoming more and more firm for implications with not just respiratory disease, but also with stroke and heart disease. And overall, we can expect to see reduced life expectancy in the people that succumb to the effects of air pollution, particularly with those compounds. We know that pregnancy is a very vulnerable time, both for the unborn baby and for the mother. It's during the first few months of pregnancy that a lot of rapid growth takes place. Cellular division takes place to form all the major organs, and if there's any interruption to that at that point, you can see problems in those particular systems later on in life. As I mentioned before, there's a problem with lung function in children, and pediatricians are reporting this as a huge problem. Lungs are supposed to keep growing until children reach possibly early adolescence. And scans of children's lungs are showing a terrifying stunting of the growth of lungs of children who have been exposed to air pollution. And the onset of asthma in children who didn't have asthma, and also an exacerbation of asthmatic symptoms. On into adulthood, we start to see an impact on, again, asthma is always at the top of the list, and that's not a surprise because asthma is a condition where the lungs are particularly vulnerable to any changes, and they can narrow, the airways can narrow very quickly. That can cause an asthmatic event. If that's not dealt with adequately, or if the asthmatic event is particularly bad, that can actually lead to death. Lung cancer, diabetes, and dementia. Dementia is something that was studied in Canada, and I'll show you some results on that study shortly. And the increase in heart attack and heart failure as a result of exposure to air pollution. I just mentioned about the Canada study. You can just see here at the top. Now, this study was undertaken to look at the association between dementia, Parkinson's disease, and MS, and proximity to living next to a major road. And this study was done over a considerable period of time. A large amount of participants in the study. There was no particular association seen between proximity to road and the different stages there on the graph, simply showing proximity to road versus your risk for developing dementia. MS as well, no obvious trend there. But people who lived under or within 50 metres of a major traffic thoroughfare had an increased risk of dementia. And that became less the further away that people lived from those roads. So it was very much what could be described as a dose-dependent relationship. And when you're trying to examine cause and effect, that can give you a good idea that there probably is a reasonable chance that this is an accurate reflection of what was going on there. Also, it was considered that noise may well have had an impact too. But for this purpose today, we're looking particularly at air pollution. That study was conducted for around about 10 years, so it's a very robust study. So, we know that it's implicated in heart disease, dementia, and we mentioned respiratory disease. I'm just going to talk to you a little bit about Ella Cassidebra. Ella died in 2013. She lived in Lewisham, which is very close to the South Circular Road. And I'm telling you her story because it's important about what might happen for the future of governance, of the regulations around air pollution. She went to hospital about 30 times during the last 3 or 4 years of her life. And each of her asthmatic episodes were tracked by Professor Stephen Holgate once it was posthumously, unfortunately. And each time she was admitted to intensive care, which was 4 times in her life, it coincided exactly with a spike in air pollution levels in London. Her asthma was so bad that on autopsy, her lungs looked like the lungs of someone who worked in diesel for very many years. Her mother has campaigned since about 2015, 2016 to have her cause of death reopened because it was left quite unresolved. And in fact, the coroner at the time recorded that she died from something in the air because she had no other reason to have asthma. The house was dust free, they didn't have pets, all of the usual triggers just weren't there. And just this year, her mother has been able to have the Attorney General agree to reopen. The reason that this is important is that air pollution may well go onto her death certificate following the second inquiry. So we have to think about what that might mean if that then becomes something that government can be challenged on, if air pollution is actually on a death certificate. Back in 2016, the Royal College of Physicians and Royal College of Paediatric and Child Health undertook a study to look at the lifelong impact of air pollution. And back then, they estimated that around about 40,000 deaths a year in the UK could well be attributed to air pollution. And they then, back then, linked it to the various things I mentioned, cancer, asthma, COPD, etc. And held that the evidence for damage is right across the life course. So they updated with a progress report, I think, last year. And they actually put forward some proposals. Because in the view of the Royal College of Physicians and their partners, nothing really has been tackled properly in the UK, and as you may well all know, it's case after case that you read in the headlines of the UK breaking the limits on what is supposed to be the safe levels of air pollution. They suggest we put the onus back on polluters to take responsibility. I don't know how we do that. But it must be at a political level, not just nationally, but locally. Somebody said to me recently, what would happen if we started to look at air pollution in terms of house buying? Our area is just going to become completely uninhabitable. That's something that can't happen. We need better monitoring of air pollution because at the moment in London there is simply just a handful of monitors. I know that there are apps that exist to monitor air pollution and they tend to be linked to these handful of air pollution monitors. And so you really don't have an updated and live what's happening immediately around you. And I think if we did, I think we'd all be lobbying for more change. Looking at workplaces and schools, one of the big worries is the amount of new schools being built in London very close to major routes. A study only a year or two ago monitored the air quality inside a classroom and was found to be worse than outside the classroom. It was inside than it was outside. Because once the air had entered the classroom, that's where it stayed. So Fairfax Local Authority suggested, we could put a filter in. Well, it's really not really going to change the problem. Okay. And lead by example. The NHS could really probably do more as an entity. So I'm going to I'm involved in talking about how many people might die from this and helping actors understand how they can mitigate any particular risk, but I'm not really going to do that today. And in fact, I think it was Claire Jones that did that in Last Year, the Actuary just last year. But we know it's not working. Whatever's happening with the government and trying to monitor and regulate what's going on, it's not working. We get headline after headline after headline of what's going on with air pollution. So there are some changes being made with the updating of the emission zones, but is that enough? World Health Organization tells us what we should be doing. We all know what we should be doing, but that's on a very personal level. And we know, of course, there are regions of the planet that we don't really have any control over. But if we can start with small changes in the UK and then Europe-wide, then we may be able to change things. So the obvious things, reducing the carbon footprint, etc., etc. But as I say, I'm not going to tell you that today. So last year, Claire Jones wrote in the Actuary magazine, and she said, well, so what can we do? What can you do? I'm not an actuary. So knowing about the topic, she said, is some way of starting to help other understanding. And she does specifically look at how to set your mortality assumptions, communicate widely how you're making that approach, understanding there's going to be uncertainties, but at least knowing about the base levels, the base risks rather, and how they might affect your different age groups that you're working with. And perhaps we should be looking at how we can address the gaps in modelling the risk. Maybe that's something we can do as part of the climate change working group. So on a wider level, now I'm not an expert in how to advise on investments. So I'm going to tell you what has been happening in the insurance sector with regards to approaching this from a greener point of view. So one of the things here is the UBS Life Climate Aware World Equity Fund, where the fund is trying to move away from support of the fossil fuel industry and towards more of the renewable energy sector, which seems obvious, really. There's going to be some initial investment in the fund from UBS, and it's hoped that they will also be able to stimulate research and interest in technologies that will help to, face the challenge of CO2 emissions that we're facing, but also in more renewable energy. I mean, I now live in the south of France, and I'm absolutely amazed that there's very few solar panels, for instance, where I live, and it's just sunshine city. There's 320 days of sunshine a year, so it still seems everywhere is so behind the curve in all of this. We do have a problem with some of the larger nations. We have a problem with the US and their current approach to their skeptical approach to climate change and air pollution as a whole. But we know it's happening, and it's happening today. Given the heat wave of the last week or two in Europe, we know that climate change and air pollution are all heading us down the wrong path. Seniors at Nest and at UBS talk about how that they want four building blocks to making this work. So making sure that when companies report back on their low carbon commitment that they're being honest, and there's a better regulation of this. It's the carbon disclosure program, which is supposed to stimulate a corporate role in reducing air pollution. And also to stimulate interest in new renewable energies. So. And some issues which are probably, I guess, some of you are aware of, that insurers are moving away from coal and CO2-related risks. Many assets being moved out from that area and, in fact, refusing to even underwrite and insure some of the greater carbon risks. Particularly, I see that AXA stopped covering coal power-related projects. Other insurers, including some of the reinsurers as well, Swiss Re, Munich Re, and Scor, have some underwriting restrictions. And I think the answer really, you've got to divest from correlated interests. There's no point in trying to understand how high to risk around air pollution if we're just driving it at the other end. So I think my main point is that it's a threat to health and life as we know this. And we know that it's affecting today, that Ella is the only child to die from asthma attack. There are very many more, not just in the UK, but around the world. And we all each have our own personal responsibility, and I think we're well aware of that, but there is a corporate responsibility. And if we're able in our roles and within our jobs, I certainly don't, but we have the influence to be able to move any kind of interest or investment away from the coal industry, away from a carbon releasing industry, we can try to start reducing the amount that goes into the air. And I think my question really back at everybody is, do we think we've reached the tipping point, or do we think it's ultimately fixable? So thank you for listening, and I'm very happy to take questions.
Just a second, can we get the microphone over here, guys? And then if you guys can just state your name and your fellowship status before you ask the question, please. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm Erica from PwC. And it's quite interesting to hear about the air pollution. I don't pretend to be an expert on this field. And you talk about like nitrogen dioxide. My impression was that carbon footprint is more related to, say, carbon dioxide and global warming.
Yes, but also the carbon emissions that come from burning, that also adds to particulate matter.
Mm.
So you get a particulate matter compounds that come from burning of any kind of carbon compound.
Do we have any insights around what is the impact of global warming and what is the impact of air pollution?
Well, there's an interaction between some of the compounds and air temperature. So we hear about ozone as a gas, not just in the atmosphere, but at ground level, and that will react with some of the compounds I talked about, like oxides of nitrogen, and they will themselves
just in the front here.
Thank you. My name is David Simmons, and thank you for a very interesting talk. One thing that you mentioned in your talk, the ultra-low emission zone, and this has been a particular bugbear of myself and many people I know. For those of us who live in London might have heard that the plan is to extend it to the North Circular Road. And why that's a particular bugbear is that that's an area where there is least infrastructure for electric vehicles, and the result being that perfectly working motor vehicles are going to have to be chucked to probably be replaced by a vehicle that is either petrol or going to be hybrid, simply because if I personally was to buy an electric car, I've got nowhere to actually charge it. So the question is, what are we really achieving by bringing that in now? Would we gain by holding the introduction until we can bring in an infrastructure for electric vehicles?
I think you're right. should have a positive impact, then I agree with you, if there are disruptions.
I'm just following, has someone looked at the emissions from scrapping the cars that people are going to have to check in and creating the new cars? That I'm just wondering if this is really scientific based.
I don't know is the answer. So I've been running those, but it should strategize that as well. So the other cities around the world that have introduced the emission zones, I think have better infrastructure to some of the Nordic countries in terms of ability to charge and have a transport. Many of our cities are much more cheaper and more efficient. So it's been an easier introduction, I think, for us.
Gish, I'm three rows back over there.
Nick Spencer, fellow. Gomo Cherry-March talked about the sort of soaring rates of asthma and sort of lung disease and heart. And I think that the part that's maybe initially surprising, if you go back to the 60s or the Victorian times in London, I mean, you had pea soupers, you could barely move, you know, everyone had smoke fires. Is it a particular type of emissions, or what's causing the emissions, or is it the fact that these particles are smaller and so less visible? But the surprise is, why is it soaring away now, or is there something in the mix that's changed rather than just pollution relative to those pea super days?
Yeah. I would suggest it's partly to do with the smaller compound. Say the initial straightforward soot is about 3 and 10, which would have caused a respiratory wheeze, as we would have seen with open coal lines, etc., steam trains, and then the coal smoke that comes out of those. So I would say it's to do with the smaller compound. Possibly also that some of the industry manufacturing has developed now that perhaps wouldn't be done at the time, so some of the compound. There's some interest around the interaction between some of the compound as well, perhaps in the latter part of the 20th century rather than those that were around during the former part. So there's probably quite a few different risk factors going on there that's resulted in this issue.
And then at the back there, Emma.
Thank you. Simon Grout, fellow. You referred to a Canadian study, and you just mentioned in one of your answers around the Nordics. And you also mentioned our friends over the pond and the doubters there. When you've got countries like China and India probably contributing the vast majority of this, are there any longitudinal studies there that can be drawn on? Because you know, the sort of data that you were looking at and the graphs you're putting up there, it's going to take 30, 40 years to prove what you're saying, which I don't doubt. But on the other hand, by that time, it's going to be too late.
Well, there was an interesting study that came out in China during the 50s, perhaps slightly earlier. There were two different winter fuel policies between the north and the south. So people in the north of China were given winter fuel because that region was able to afford it. In the south, they weren't. So what we see now is a discrepancy in life expectancy. If you look at respiratory-related disorders of a few years, maybe 4 or 5 years, between that particular cohort, between the north and the south, because the north could be overwind over fuel, using it for warmth, the south didn't have it. And that leads to now spoken about today.
Got a question over there from the lady over there.
Hi, I'm Zamina Gill and I'm a fellow. I'm also not a life insurer, I work for a general insurance company. And one of the aspects we look at is casualty coverage. So, for example, major companies are being sued. For example, there's been one recently with talcum powder possibly having an impact, a possibly spurious impact on ovarian cancer as a class action lawsuits have arisen out of these cases, led by just, in some cases, a very small number of claimants. Have we seen anything like that in the pollution space?
Only
start becoming an issue more for general insurers as well as life insurers and health insurers. Thank you.
We've got a question to your left.
Jack Carmichael, student. So I see from one side of the air pollution problem, it's going to be kind of removing those particles from the air. But from the kind of medical side, I understand that the lungs aren't really like the kidneys. You can't do dialysis on the lungs. So I see you can't really do dialysis on the lungs like that you can do the kidneys. But in terms of kind of medical advances in the future, can you kind of see kind of any cures for this from the medical side?
Hi, Stuart McDonald, fellow. You talked about both macro factors, so the US starts digging more coal or a new coal factory in China and the whole world suffers, but also the micro factors, you know, the harm of living by a busy road or airport or your north-south China example. And I was just wondering what the balance is. So if I just decide to escape London and go to the south of France or out into the country, am I avoiding 80% of the risk or 20%? Yeah, the ONS or somebody publishes some air data for London, and I just remember looking at sort of heat maps, and the worst streets appeared very much worse than the best streets. So I sort of had it in my head that this was very much a local factor.
question in the front over here.
Hi, Louise Pryor. This isn't so much a question as a comment. I knew that air pollution was bad and that it had serious effects. I hadn't quite realised quite how bad. But it really strikes me how it's so tied up with basically climate change, in that they're both essentially caused by us burning fossil fuels. And it strikes me that we're always raising fear, uncertainty and doubt by saying how awful everything is, how awful climate change is going to be, which is true, how awful, how we're killing people through air pollution, which is true. And maybe we need to think about this and say, well, look, if we cut down on fossil fuels, yes, we've got the fantastic long-term effect that we have a world to live in, essentially, but also we have this fantastic, much shorter-term effect that we and our children get less ill and we live longer. So it's maybe a really useful thing to be able to talk out as a very positive short-term effect on doing the right thing in the long term. Also, just to point out to all the non-life insurers here, another latent risk here, latent claims we might have, liability claims. If air pollution is actually fingered as a specific cause of death, you can bet that there will be liability claims coming out of that, and that's something that the insurers nearly really need to worry about. And it's also something they can do quite a lot about by putting in explicit exclusions now, which saves them money, but also really, really brings it home to especially the directors and officers who buy D&O cover, that if they are not insured for various types of liability, they are more likely to take it seriously.
I have a question. So from all the work you've been doing and all the learnings, not only from the UK, but from China, for example, have you seen any of that embedded in product development for insurers? Interesting. I think we had a question right there.
Hi, Paul Perrett, fellow. Sort of questions, observations. I was surprised by two things you said. Firstly, the lack of air monitor detectors. I would have just assumed that there are lots of them, and because if you can't measure it, you can't really do much about it. So I was just very interested, and I would have thought with the guy over there, the ultra low emission zone, well, you would have thought they would have all these things measuring, well, is it having an effect? The other thing that I was quite surprised about was you were quite negative on air filters. So I would have thought as an immediate thing that you could do is perhaps for indoors somehow filter the air so that at least when you're indoors the air is better quality than when you're outdoors. But you seem to be a bit negative on that.
Hi, Paul Murray from Swiss Re. So I had a bit of personal experience on this topic. It's an N equals one study, but I moved to Hong Kong in 2010 and my 3-year-old son got respiratory problems and he had asthma for the 4 years we were there. and when we moved back to the UK, it stopped. We live outside London, so maybe that's a factor, but it's an N equals one. So it's quite personal for me. Louise, I think the insurance industry has a really important responsibility here, and I think they're taking it seriously, but I'd like to just emphasise this point, the fact that companies are taking steps now to reduce investments as well as insurance for companies that have a thermonuclear exposure, a thermal coal exposure, is really powerful. So Swiss Re is just one of many, right? But we've said we won't insure or reinsure a company that has more than 30% of exposure to that. So it's a first step. It's hard to get it down to zero at the moment, but I think it's a step in the right direction. So I think that's important. The longitudinal study that I've seen that was quite good was the global burden of disease one, 1990 to 2015, or 2005, I think it was. That showed, they tried to show the net effect of particulate pollution exposure, and they showed, unsurprisingly, that it had increased significantly in developing economies. That actually showed it reduced a little bit in the USA, but honestly, I don't know if it's credible enough. But I think the big issue, right, if we want to make an insurance question, is how can we start to measure exposure? And in the case of the individual, the little girl, it's this question mark of what was the real cause of death. If we can get an answer to that question and also have some good tests that show, what is a meaningful level of exposure and impairment to health, then we can start to talk about insurance products.
Hi, sorry, I just want to actually follow up on the comment over there about the air filtering. And I've read about a school in the City of London where they redesigned the traffic flow, they greened up the sort of hedges around the outside, added green to the playgrounds, and had a very significant reduction in pollutants and a very large increase in air quality. And I don't know if you know that, say, for example, rather, or something in terms of, again, these can be, not having the cars there in the first place would be best, but on a localized basis that there are architectural and green techniques that can actually improve the situation, at least around the local area.
We've got a question over there. Oh, actually, first go there, Fisher, and then Emma next over there.
Claire Jones, fellow. I, as well as writing the article in the Actuary that you mentioned earlier, I led a working party group that looked at the effects of air pollution on mortality assumptions, particularly in the context of pension schemes. One of the things that we found was that the research that has been done outside the actuarial profession has not been particularly helpful in terms of focusing on the things that are most helpful to actuaries. In particular, the studies focus on the headline number of deaths, rather than looking at factors such as the impact on life expectancy, whether the air pollutants are just accelerating deaths of people who are already in poor health, or whether the impact is more substantial. They also tend to report impacts on mortality rates for the population as a whole, without differentiating by gender or by age. I'd be interested to know if in your conversations with insurers you're seeing much appetite to research those factors that would be more useful for actuaries in their assessment of life expectancy impacts.
I've read in the media recently quite a lot about microplastic, so kind of like ultra-fine plastic dust in the air. Do you consider that air pollution, and is it as serious as the pollutants you've mentioned?
I didn't include it. I read a bit about it. I understand enough to really include it this time, but I think it probably could be considered air pollution. Plastic, in a way, Neil Christie, student. So you talked about kind of filters and things, about, you know, kind of ways and reducing emissions and how we're going to potentially reduce this going forward. What about now? Is there anything that we can be doing to actually improve the air quality? Because obviously all this stuff's already there. Is there any kind of way to tackle that? Or on a kind of more wider scale? Sorry, I think I've maybe not explained myself very well. I sort of more so meant the actual matter that's in the air now.
Yes.
Is there anything we can do to kind of target removing that from the air?
Yeah,
rather than ways to kind of prevent it going forward.
Sorry, as a kind of follow-up to that question, how long do the particles stay in the air? Do they have a very long half-life, or are they taken out quite fast by... Yeah, but I mean, if it rains, because I live in central London, I can tell the difference with the pollution. I've also got asthma. Yeah, when it's windy, when it rains, it feels less polluted.
Yes.
Is that the pollution being taken out of the air and then rapidly being replaced by vehicle fumes, or... Just wondering how quickly the impact would be when people change to electric vehicles, when the ULEZ comes into effect.
From an acute symptomatic point of view, I would suggest that it would be quite mediated quite quickly. If you have asthma, you're not going to get an exacerbation from asthma. In air, may well have an asthma. I don't know whether it's still going to be subject to the last or the other contact.
Thanks.
I might be talking complete rubbish here, but I think before the Beijing Olympics, wasn't there something done to remove the particulates over Beijing by exploding things which probably had a lot of particulates in them above Beijing to try and get it to rain?
To answer your question on how fast the particles can actually decompose that or whatever, actually, if closing down all the
stops,
it does have a quick effect of better weather or blue sky or whatever. And actually, it is a general practice in Beijing at the moment. So when there are like big meetings or whatever. Are closed around Beijing, like in Hebei or northern China areas.
Any further questions? Oh, over there's one.
Fellow, very light question to end it. Should we all be walking around with masks on? Do you think they help, basically?
There's a time limit on the efficacy of masks. So, a few minutes, maybe, I don't know. Some are more effective than others, depending on the whole day. You probably have to put on the, you know, like a kind of respirator, do it with air and
just following up from a previous question about how long these particles, the nitrogen oxide ones that you mentioned, so I was hearing a statistic recently that carbon dioxide hangs around for about 120 years, methane for about 15 years, but the nitrogen oxide ones that you mentioned, do you know how long they stay around before they break down?
Thank you. I'm very pleased with the amount of questions we've had tonight. Clearly, we've had a very attentive audience, so thank you for all the questions. They've been very well received. And Nicola, thank you for coming to share your thoughts with us. Yes, Nicola, is, we love linking in with Nicola on all her medical knowledge, and I know she's got a working party for diabetes at the moment, so hopefully you can share that sometime soon. So the two bottles of champagne, if you can come pick them up afterwards, they are awarded to Erica for your good contribution throughout the evening, and then also to Claire Jones for your very solution-orientated questions. So please do come pick up your champagne afterwards. And then if you guys can complete the online surveys afterwards, that would be very much appreciated. Networking drinks are outside, so please do help yourself to some and some sandwiches and have a conversation with Nicola. And then I just like to draw the meeting to a close in the usual way by thanking the speaker.